Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 121. Oh my god, I just went back in time. Episode 121 of The Morning After.
Oh no, I'm not here.
Sari, we've been
Sari
so
got
back.
Erased from the photo suddenly.
Somehow. Well, I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I am Sari Kamen.
You are Sari Kamen.
And I am
you
here.
Are definitely here right now. Also in studio today, one part of the couple behind Grimm Artisanal Ales in Brooklyn, Miss Lauren Grimm. And also in studio, Yael Raviv, you may remember her from a few episodes ago with Sarah Kramer, Sarah Hymanson, and Yael talking about Umami, the Umami Art and Food Festival, which she is the founder of. She's also one part of the company Kinetic Art, and they have just developed the first ever James Beard app. So we'll talk to her about that later in the show. Also later in the show, another edition of the Morning After quiz that we will give to Yael and Lauren. We'll see how they do. But first, Sari's got some food news for us.
I do, yeah. Very, very political food news this week, I have to say.
Really?
It's a very controversial week in the world of food. First of all...
Sounds so serious about it.
It is serious.
Okay.
First of all, Taco Bell... Speaking of serious, it's actually run by an organization called Yum! Exclamation mark Brands. And so that company has created...
poor punctuation and... sorry.
No. You can just put the exclamation right in the middle of that. No problem. We're talking about we do whatever we want. And speaking of... So they've opened a restaurant in Dallas, Texas, which is called Bon Shop, as in banh mi, which we all know are delicious Vietnamese-style sandwiches. So that all sounds well and good, except that their logo is actually the red five-pointed star logo, which signifies communist Vietnam. Oops. So... So Dallas actually has a very high population of Vietnamese people, many of which are traumatized and offended by the logo of the banh mi shop. It brings back some bad memories.
That's really awful.
It's a little bit insensitive, probably more just unbelievably careless. Like, I picture it, some guy just Googled, like, Vietnam logo, and that came up, and then they were like, I found it!
Yeah, it was like the first, like, Wikipedia
yeah, exactly.
picture
like,
about
the first
Vietnam
Google
War.
Image that came up. So the Vietnamese community created an online petition. They're very upset, and the executive from Yum Brands has apologized. He's like, oh, I didn't know that was... insensitive. Really sorry about that. So apparently they're going to fix it, but you know.
I mean, I also think that there should be a petition started by anyone of Mexican heritage against Taco Bell masquerading as actual Mexican food.
I mean, absolutely. This I'm telling you, it's a whole can of worms. It's very politicized.
It's going to be like Yum question mark now.
Yum/racism. Okay. So another world food news. PBR. Everyone's favorite hipster American brew. I mean, we are in Bushwick, right? Was sold. PBR was sold to Oasis Beverages, which is a Russian beer brewer and distribution company. Can I not talk today? Distribution company.
You were saying disbeerbrution.
Okay. Yep. Sorry about that. So PBR was sold for over $700 billion to Oasis Beverages. I definitely want to hear from you, Lauren. You're looking like you're chomping at the bit. My favorite part of this is that the chairman of Oasis, who is a Russian feller, said PBR is the quintessential American brand. It represents individualism, egalitarianism, a lot of big words today, and freedom of expression. Working with them is a dream come true, said this Russian businessman of working with this unbelievably nationalistic American brand. Lauren, talk to us.
Well, that kind of is happening all the time now
yeah.
in the beer business. I mean, these larger companies, you know, like that exist in the U.S. and Belgium and Russia, they are, you know, trying to keep with it. And how do you do that? But you acquire brands. You just, like, continue to, like, buy up new, you know, well, old beer brands and grow your company that way. rather than, you know, the craft beer movement, which is, you know, all of these, you know, new small breweries starting up and making names for themselves. It's like when you're, you know, a huge corporation, how do you compete with that?
But can you still be a hipster American beer if you're owned by a Russian organization? I mean, does this change things?
Yeah,
is this
I
a game changer?
I don't know. Like,
can you even drink that with brunch?
It's true.
Brunch is American.
Yeah. Well, Goose Island was bought up by a huge Belgium corporation, and
but they're not our enemy. I mean, you know,
Russia is not our enemy.
It's not that.
However,
not our
that
enemy.
Is controversial.
That is controversial. And I just want to say, I mean, this is adding a whole nother layer to this, but I'm pretty sure that Putin just signed something that bans all like Western food imports to come into Russia because he was protesting the sanctions that the Western companies placed on Russia after the whole like Malaysian flight debacle that landed in the Ukraine. Well, in Ukraine. So, I mean, how does this even work?
Yeah, in Russia, they're probably not drinking PBR. They are just buying.
Well, they're
PBR
definitely not
selling
yeah,
it to
they can't
Americans.
Get it. I don't know. This whole thing is very complex. It's very multi-layered.
Also, like $700 billion.
I know, for that shitty ass.
Actually,
no one from PBR is in the studio right now, right?
I mean, I was just going to say, like, there's this festival called the Great American Beer Festival, and every year they...
Sponsored by Russia!
They, like, have all of these competitions, and PBR, like, wins time for, like, you know, it's like American, you know... I don't know what the category
flabby,
is, but...
The most American.
I mean, I don't know... I just say I do not enjoy PBR, and therefore Russia can have it.
F them.
What else is in the news, Sari?
Well, moving just a little bit west, Germany, the innovator of all things useful, has created a company that now delivers airport food to your home. So you don't have to fly to get shitty ass airport food.
Wait, via airplane?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
No.
Via drone.
Yeah, via drone, exactly. No, they just knock. I don't know actually how they get there, maybe.
I would love that.
Well, yeah. You know would what? You? Hey, Germany, there's something called TV dinner, and it was invented in, what, the 50s?
By America.
By America.
You did it first, Germany.
I guess maybe they are like, you know, more focused on like home cooking and like
that's not airport food. Airport food has never been home cooking.
Well, that's why it's like a commodity for them. It's like a fun little thing. Like, let's
like
pretend we're going on a trip in our living room.
I love space ice cream. I mean,
space ice cream is really good.
It's really good.
I'm not gonna lie, it's really good. I would like that delivered to my home. I don't, however, want airport food delivered to my home because I could eat anything else and that will be better.
So is it not? It's airplane food.
It's airplane food. It's created by the same chefs who are creating the food that is eaten on German airplanes.
Well, I mean, okay, so German airplanes, great.
Lufthansa,
specific. Lufthansa. You know, I have traveled via Lufthansa, and I have to say I wasn't so appalled.
Wasn't so appalled is not a great, like, barometer for your dinner.
Well,
wasn't
I mean,
so appalled is
horrible.
Good on an airplane because you have no other option but the food that they give you. And if you're able to get it down and not be, like, horrified, you're like, oh, that's pretty good. When you're at your home, there are so many things that aren't even at all appalling.
No, I mean, maybe, Sari, it's because they served alcoholic beverages for free with dinner. Like, they're like, oh, would you like white or red with your meal? And I was like, yes, I'm so glad I'm not American.
You're like, this
on American
is delicious. Right, yeah,
now.
Exactly.
Okay.
I can see how that would, yeah, be intriguing.
I mean, I still, I'm with you. Nobody needs a packaged meal from the airport.
Nobody
at all.
Weirdo
Seriously.
Germans.
I think it's a great week in news, Sari. I think it's a great week in international news. Highly politicized, highly emotional.
I'm emotional.
We're going to bring it down a notch.
Thank you.
Take a break. We're going to come back with Lauren Grimm of Grimm Artisanal Ales. This is The Morning After.
You are listening to Care as Currency by Spiral Jetty Club.
Make it so. the will to let it go. I owe a lot for not, I'm shy.
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Savera Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back here on The Morning After.
Betsy Andrews, you sound sexy on that drop.
Betsy Andrews has been on our show. She did sound great. She really sold
it. I know, but I never knew she had such a sexy radio voice.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah.
I think so. Listen back, Sari.
Yes.
You will, right after this. Well, Joe and Lauren Grimm are the nomadic brewers behind Grimm Artisanal Ales. Brooklyn-based, they are straight-up fermentation geeks. Welcome to the show, Lauren Grimm.
It's great to be here.
Hey, Lauren.
I love the title.
Yeah, I mean, fermentation geeks. Tell me about, I mean, what got you into fermentation? I don't think that people who don't study this kind of thing think about that aspect of beer brewing. They probably just think about the drinking part.
Yeah. You know, Joe and I, about like 9 or 10 years ago, we just got really into fermenting anything. At the time,
explain
we were,
anything. Is that like that Portlandia episode where you're like, I can pickle that?
I mean, yes. We were kind of those people.
I love that.
Living in Providence, Rhode Island, and surrounded by a bunch of other like DIY fermentation geniuses. We
not geeks, geniuses.
We started making pickles. Kimchi, sauerkraut, anything. Yeah, pretty much anything we were pickling. We made kvass, mead, and then we finally got into making beer. And I mean, I think, you know, for us, it was about the flavors that, you know, are possible through fermentation with different bacteria and yeast. And we were really into making, at the time, we were really into making wild fermented beverages. So sometimes things were good, sometimes things were not so good.
And explain wild fermentation.
Well, like right now when we make beer, we pitch pure cultures of yeast or bacteria into our beer. And so we know exactly what we're going to be getting in the end. Wild fermentation is just basically, you know, you could leave out some honey water and let it ferment because there's yeast and bacteria in the air everywhere around us. So you get whatever flavors those yeast that land in that sugary liquid are going to produce.
How, I'm just curious about like what the opposite of that would be, like for someone who doesn't know anything about fermentation, like how would you otherwise manipulate it?
like the beer strands or like the yeast strands that strains that you specifically use, correct?
Like how would we manipulate the,
like how would it be, what's not wild?
What's not wild? So like right now, well, there are hundreds of brewer's yeasts available and we buy our yeast from a yeast bank. So when we're brewing nowadays, we will order up a starter culture of a specific strain of yeast that we know about and have used before. So, you know, for instance, like we're making a saison, then we would order up our favorite farmhouse ale yeast that originates from a brewery in Belgium and was, you know, evolved in that specific brewery over hundreds of years and, you know, now you can, you know, grow it yourself.
So beer is actually magical, is what you're saying.
Beer is magical. Yeast are magical. Yeah.
So when you get a yeast strain from this brewery in Belgium, was it started as a wild yeast strain?
Yeah. You know, I mean, all of these breweries that have existed over time, they are basically isolating a yeast strain due to the reuse of it in their own brewery. So, you know, hundreds of years ago, you know, when you start up your brewery, it would be, you know, wild yeast that you would be using. But then over time, you're reusing the yeast, you're repitching it. So you'll take yeast out of a batch that is fermenting and use that yeast in a new batch that you're fermenting. And over time, you're selecting, you know, for a specific type of yeast that then develops into your house yeast.
So you guys are started as home brewers and you still basically are doing that.
Yes.
So in your apartment in Brooklyn, you begin fermentation.
We do. We, I mean, we always have a bunch of beers going at the same time. For our brewery, we make a different recipe every single time we brew at a commercial brewery. So, that means that we need to be brewing all the time, pilot batches in our apartment in Gowanus. So we'll come up with an idea and make up a recipe. And then, you know, sometimes we need to tweak that recipe. So we might make a batch, you know, a couple of times at home. And then when we have it the way we want it, we'll scale it up and make some tweaks, you know, due to the differences in equipment and water and stuff like that.
So when you invite people over for dinner, where do you put your batches?
Are you asking? Do you want to?
I would love to come over for dinner. But I just know that, you know, like, you know,
where do we?
That's got to take
do you
a lot
sleep
of
is the better question.
No, it was really funny because, like, I remember having a friend over a week ago, and she was like, "Oh my gosh, you have so much beer all over your apartment. You just need to have a party." And I was like, "What?" I was like, "Well, you know, I mean, to me, these aren't like necessarily all perfect. These are pilot batches. They're not perfect, and I don't want to, like, you know, be like, this is my beer, you know, if it has, for me, if it's not perfect."
So a byproduct of fermentation is carbon dioxide.
Yes.
How are you not poisoning yourself?
Where
your
do you sleep and how are you alive?
Yeah.
I mean, a byproduct of life is carbon dioxide.
Sure, good
so
point.
Maybe.
Good point.
Ooh, snap.
So we are not dying due to inhaling carbon dioxide. That's we have this like deep freezer in our basement where we have the ability to dial in temperature, basically controlling temperature during the fermentation of our pilot batches. And sometimes when we'll have actively fermenting beer in there, and I'll open up the deep freezer and I'm like, "Oh my God, this is crazy."
I'm about to pass out.
Pretty much. Wow. Don't stick your head in there.
I mean, it truly is something that happens in winemaking and in beer making. Like, you can seriously hurt yourself aside from that. So you're starting the batches at your apartment in Brooklyn, and then the term, you know, nomadic or gypsy brewer kind of definitely pertains to you guys, because you're taking that and then you're going and you're making it somewhere else and not in a space that you always make beer in.
So once we get a recipe that we like, we will call up breweries and schedule a day to go in and make the beer. So We've made beer in Massachusetts, and now lately we've been going to Northern Virginia outside of D.C. to a brewery. So we'll order up ingredients, have them shipped to the brewery. Some of the ingredients we'll bring in our car, and we'll go there and make the wort, which basically means, you know, it's like an eight-hour day where you mash the grain and boil the wort. And then once that's, we basically the boil's finished, you cool it, you add yeast, and then it goes into a fermenter for the next few weeks. So at that point, you know, we basically leave it up to the brewery to control the temperature, and then we'll come and package it and bring it back to New York.
And then how do you get it bottled and shipped?
There's a mobile bottler that comes to the brewery. He basically has a truck with bottling equipment. And
really?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So he shows up and helps to bottle our beer. And then Joe and I schedule with a freight company to come and pick it up. I mean, it's usually a few pallets of beer. So they'll bring it back to New York to our distributors' warehouses. And then it goes out from there.
So I just read that you guys make a new beer every single month.
We do.
How is that even possible?
It's kind of crazy.
And this is a beer that ends up being distributed?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that as people who started as home brewers, the homebrewing culture is just so, you know, creative and inventive. Homebrewers are always into making new beers and experimenting. And actually, I think that's what's driven the renaissance in craft beer these days. You have people who started out as home brewers actually starting commercial breweries and making really flavorful, inventive beers. So, yeah, Joe and I, in that vein, we were like, well, you know, we don't have our own brewery. We don't need to make a flagship beer. You know, a lot of times it's like it costs so much money to start a brewery, and you kind of have to have, you know, a beer that you're pumping out like over and over to sell to be able to pay your bills. So we don't have those kinds of bills. And so we decided, well, we'll just like, you know, make the beers that we want to be making. And if people like them, they like them.
So basically if a beer style, a specific beer runs out, that's it.
Yep, that's it. So they're just limited edition batches.
Wow.
We remade one once for our 1 year anniversary. We remade a beer.
Oh, that's like beer nerd romance.
I know.
Actually, honey, let's make that beer we made the day we met.
our friend who actually draws the labels for our beers. She's always making fun of me and Joe. She's like, "Do you hold hands when you're brewing?" It's pretty funny.
Like, yeah. Well, like, I guess kind of to go on top of that, like, you know, you're brewing as a couple. Do you ever have like moments where you're like, no, this doesn't taste right? And he's like, yes,
it tastes
right.
It does. I think we both agree to what tastes bad. You know, I mean, it's like, well, you know, I mean, there's the question of taste. There are differences in opinions about whether something tastes good. But then in beer, there are off flavors. And those are just, you know, across the board, everybody agrees, don't have those in your beer. So I think Joe and I agree most of the time about the flavors that we like and the flavors that we don't like. We both have our own projects that we're working on. You know, it's like one of us will be like, oh, I want to, you know, make a beer with apple cider in it. Cool, I'm gonna like write up a recipe and get that started. And you know, the other one might, you know, be like, oh, I want to make a imperial stout, so I'm just gonna like, you know, put some stuff together.
But that's so much beer, like, to make a new one every so single month.
It is.
And then how do you decide?
Yeah.
Do you ever fight like, oh, I want to make a porter, and he's like, no, I want to make an IPA this month?
It's more just, you mean like for our commercial batches?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it takes so long. Like, by the time we're making a commercial beer, it's been like 6 to 9 months that that's already been like in the works. Most of, you know, mostly because of federal regulation requires us to submit recipes to them to approve. So, so, you know, it's like we have to have our
the FDA.
Yeah. Well, not the FDA, the TTB, the Tobacco Trade Tax Bureau. There's alcohol in there somewhere, but it didn't make it into the abbreviation.
It's just not very important.
But yeah, they require anything that has a non-standard brewing ingredient to you to submit a recipe to them that they'll approve, which I understand when it comes to ingredients that are, you know, subpar. You know, I don't want you know, it's like Four Loko. What's in that? I don't know. But our beer, it's like if we add elderflowers to it, all of a sudden, that's a non-standard brewing ingredient. You have to have a recipe approved. And since Joe and I love to add non-standard brewing ingredients to our beers, we're constantly doing that. But yes, to make a long story short, there's a lot of planning that goes into this. So there's no like point at which we're like, no, I want to brew this one this month. No, I want to brew this
one. It's like, we can do that one later. We're doing this one now.
Yeah.
That's good.
So, I mean, I know you're creating a different beer all the time, but I imagine you still feel like you have a house style. How would you describe your style?
You know, actually, not that long ago, Joe and I were at a beer dinner where this restaurant paired like 8 of our beers with courses. And it was the first time that we had had that many of our beers at once, like in one sitting. And both of us looked at each other and were like, we totally have a style. I mean, I think in general, we make a lot of Belgian style beers. So saisons, triples, doubles, lots of Trappist yeast and farmhouse ales. So that is definitely a part of our style, but I mean, because we brew a different batch every month, they're geared towards the seasons. So, you know, in wintertime we have been making porters, stouts, that kind of thing, but they're always, definitely, part of the, you know, Belgian brewing tradition, things that are, less dense beers, even our Imperial Stout, you know, it was pretty drinkable for an Imperial Stout, which is usually a very thick, heavy-bodied, sweet beer. And then, I mean, we just love, like, full-flavored beers. So, you know, often we are, you know, using yeast for that yeast flavor, getting, you know, in Belgian brewing, that's a major part of the you know, profile of those beers is focusing on yeast flavor. So spicy phenolic flavors in some beers, and then in other beers like citrus and black pepper or fruity flavors. So that's always something that we...
Yum.
Yeah, no, I mean, we had the Bearded Ladies on the show who are super beer enthusiasts, Meredith and Haley, and one of them said that Grimm was their favorite brewery.
Really?
Right now.
So, I mean, have to listen to that episode.
Yeah, I mean, I do think you guys are doing very original things, and the idea that no batch is ever going to taste like the other batch is pretty exciting. Do you have ideas of actually opening a brewery space?
It's a good question. I mean, for a long time, Joe and I were like, no, definitely not doing it. But at this point, it's been getting harder and harder to find breweries that have time for us to come in and brew beer. You know, the brewing industry is going crazy right now, and most breweries can't keep up with their own production. So, you know, letting us use a fermenter that could be filled with, you know, their own beer is getting harder and harder to find. So, yeah, I don't know. We don't have any, you know, firmed up plans, but it's definitely in the back of our minds. There are so many things that we can't do at breweries that we would love to do. Like making sour beers is always problematic. And we actually just came out with a barrel-aged beer, and for a long time we couldn't find anyone who would let us put, you know, spirit or wine barrels in their space. So we were pretty excited about that one.
But. Is that your latest beer?
It's our latest beer, yes.
So what's it called?
It's called Bees with a Buzz.
Bees with a Buzz. Did that correlate with Honey Week?
No, actually, I don't even know when Honey Week was. When?
It was like 2 weeks
ago. It was like two weeks. Oh, my gosh. Don't tell anyone.
No big deal.
Don't tell anyone.
No, nobody's there.
So what's the website so we can send people to check out what's going on with you guys?
Our website is Grimm, G-R-I-M-M, like the fairy tales, ales.com.
Where can we buy your beer?
That's a good question. Well, we're sitting in Roberta's. They don't have it on tap now, but they often have it on tap here. We're at like craft beer bars all over Brooklyn, some in Manhattan.
So anywhere they don't sell PBR.
Yeah, pretty much.
Whatever fine beers are sold.
You can definitely get their Action Adventure at Terroir Tribeca.
Oh,
yeah.
So totally, my beer list. And then you guys have an Instagram and Twitter, I imagine?
We do. Instagram is, I think it's Grimm.
Oh, no. Are they the same, your Instagram and your Twitter?
They're what? Oh, yeah, okay. So Facebook is Grimm Artisanal Ales. Instagram and Twitter are both Grimm Ales.
G-R-I-M-M.
Yes.
A-L-E-S.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
Well, we're going to take a break here on The Morning After. We'll be right back with Yael Raviv of the company Kinetic Art, and they've just developed the first ever James Beard app. This is The Morning After on Heritage Radio. Listening to Gluten Free Us by the Spiral Jetty Club.
I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
And you're listening to The Morning After on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I am one of your two hosts. I am Sari Kamen, and I'm with
Jesse Kiefer.
Yes, in the studio in the back of Roberta's Pizza. We just had a lovely talk with Lauren Grimm from Grimm Ales. And if you're tuning in right now, very excited to say hello to Yael Raviv. Hi, Yael. Yael is the VP of Content Partnership with Kinetic Art, which is a company that creates very, how do I describe it? Futuristic, maybe? Just very forward-thinking, interactive cooking apps.
That's a good sketch. We'd like to change the cookbook industry
by merging it with the digital age. Right, perfect. Yeah, the last app you made was Look and Cook.
Yep.
And that actually, you can look at it and you can see how the food is actually being made. So that's pretty revolutionary. Yeah, it's literally a digital cookbook, but it's, you know, it's even more so. It's almost 3D, I should say.
It's totally 3D. No, it's still 2D, but it's step-by-step recipes and short videos. And it's the same, you know, we use the same kind of techniques in the new app we've just put out.
Which is why you're here.
Yep.
In fact. So Kinetic Art just created, and it's available now for downloading, an app called the James Beard Foundation Vegetable App.
Yep.
And you can get it on iTunes and
It's available
places.
To download for iPhone, only for iPhone right now.
Okay.
But it will be available for iPad and Android in a little bit, in a couple of months.
So first of all, it's like the coolest app ever. And second of all, it's free.
It's free to download. You get 5 free recipes. And then if you want the full set, you do have to pay.
Well, I think that's fair. I mean, someone's got to eat.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, I feel like,
all the proceeds, you know, James Beard Foundation is a nonprofit,
right.
And they do a lot of really, really good, cool stuff. So, yeah.
So how is this app, let's start here. So how is this app not just your ordinary kind of like recipe where I can, you know, search for different vegetable apps and...
Well, the thing is, for one thing, there aren't so many vegetable apps. I mean, I know it's kind of a hot topic. There's been more and more stuff about vegetables, but there's still a lot of work to do in that area. So we were, you know, wanting to fill that void in part. But also what's really special about it is that these are recipes by James Beard Award-winning chefs. They all won. All the participating chefs won the Outstanding Chef Award for James Beard. They're all fabulous chefs. They do fine dining, kind of upscale-ish food. But so it's really nice to showcase vegetables. Usually, you know, when you showcase recipes by these award winners, you see the proteins, right?
Yeah.
You see these fancy or kind of funky appetizers. You don't really see the vegetables. So it's really nice to be able to shine a light on those. And there's some really, really creative solutions, some really basic down-to-earth stuff, some really innovative, you know, it's different styles. Every chef has his own style or her style. So it's been really fun to see the variety.
So who came up with the vegetable focus concept? Was it James Beard Foundation or was it Kinetic Art?
It was in collaboration. We had a talk way back when we just came up with the idea with Mitchell Davis and Allison, who's the director of media, and James Beard. We were kind of running through different ideas. The app is based on the cookbook that James Beard Foundation put out a couple of years back. That's also based, that you know, covers the range of their outstanding award winners. And we just pulled a selection out of there, and we wanted to start with vegetables because we thought that was the one, you know, that was the area that you know, we could really make an impact in. So, yeah.
But this is the first app that James Beard Foundation has put out.
Yeah, it's so exciting to be part of that because James Beard Foundation has been around for a while, and they're a really respected, wonderful institution, but they want to appeal to a wider audience. They want to draw in younger people, and they've been doing a lot of really cool, innovative stuff, like their live camera in the kitchen. You know, they have all this, you know, they're trying to use new technology to appeal to a broader audience and to reach you know, a new constituency, if you will. So this is, I think, part of that.
It just seems so interesting. And I mean, to me, very, very appealing because I happen to love vegetables. But like for the first app that James Beard Foundation has ever decided to produce is that it's so specific and so niche. I mean, not everybody loves cooking with vegetables.
But I think that's why it's so timely, because everybody should love cooking with vegetables.
Exactly. Yeah. It is such a sign of the times in so many ways.
And also it's not a vegetarian app, I should say that, because there are a couple of recipes with bacon or, you know, you could add bacon or stuff like that. So it's not strictly vegetarian. Not all the recipes are. It's definitely an app for everybody, not just for people that, you know, have particular diets.
Yeah. I mean, how do you think that this app is affecting sort of like the food culture at large, or how it will? I mean, it feels like such a statement. It feels like such a barometer of like the direction of how cooking and just the general attitude towards food is going.
Well, when we were thinking about it and we were creating it, we were so excited by this idea. And we thought it was such a great kind of twist on the whole vegetable thing by really showcasing vegetable recipes by these high profile chefs. And it's new, so we haven't seen the impact yet, but I'm really hopeful that it will make such an impact, because I think it is a statement, particularly, you know, focusing on these specific recipes and making that James Beard's first app and all these things you just said. So you know, we are hoping for that impact. We'll see.
Yeah, and I mean, not only is the app just an amazing resource for recipes, it also just is so beautiful to look at. And you know, for me personally, I'm not biased, I don't think, but I'm just lucky enough that Yael was one of my professors when I was at school in the food studies department at NYU, and the class was talking about food and performance and kind of the overlap between food and art. And so it makes so much sense that you're an innovator that is actually, you know, tangibly kind of bridging these two separate fields and blending them into one. And just, can you talk about just like the aesthetic approach to the app?
Absolutely. It's one of the things things that drew me to work with Kinetic Art originally. When the founders got together and put out the, you know, created the first app, Look and Cook app, the idea of bringing together this very fine, detail-oriented design into this world of apps was completely innovative. You know, there are more and more apps that are kind of paying more attention to this, but I think we're still very much ahead of the curve. It's, as you said, it's beautiful. Our design team is amazing. In this particular app we worked, the production team was Mariana Velasquez did our styling, and Emily Baltz, who you may have met, she's a photographer. She did the photography, and our graphic, our creative designer is Ronen Mizrahi in Israel, and they work together, and I think both the graphic design and the photographs are just so beautiful and something we always put a premium on, because it's such a visual medium, right? The whole digital medium, you want to...
And
you know,
but just rarely do you see anyone invest that kind of time, you know, but and I think, care.
But I think that's the thing. That's part of really our mission.
Definitely.
Is to bring the joy, the pleasure of kind of leafing through a beautiful cookbook or a gorgeous magazine, right, that we so enjoy doing in print, you know, to bring that experience into the digital realm. Right. That's what we're trying to do.
Well, Look and Cook was really recognized for that. I mean, I think there was an award.
Absolutely. Apple loved us, featured us every, you know, we got a lot of recognition for that because it was really unique. And we're trying to kind of keep going with that. I mean, the design for the James Beard Foundation app is different. The colors are really beautiful. Like
it's
the
really
whole package is really nice.
Yeah. From the rest of the very oversaturated kind of food app.
We'd like to hope so.
Yeah. So can you just break it down a little bit, like how you use the app or, you know, just the different features?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. So, but again, it's a step-by-step recipe app. So each recipe, you get the, you know, the you get a beautiful kind of a collection of the ingredients that make up every dish, both visually and in a list. You can email that to yourself. Then, as you go through the step-by-step recipes, it really is very helpful in some of these very sophisticated chef's recipes to see the steps, and you have these short videos in there too. So. Even techniques that seem frightening, you could actually, it makes everything very approachable. It's a very flexible structure, so it works for very advanced cooks. You can skip over, so, I mean, you know, if you already know how to make certain things, you can just kind of skip over them, or you could really explore everything if you're a beginner cook. You can share stuff on Facebook, you can favorite things. There are all these different, they're built-in timers, which is one of my favorite features.
Wow.
Within each step, you know, so you can click on a little thing and it tells you, you know, oh, your pasta is ready or whatever. It is.
How does it know? It has a brain.
So smart. And at the end of each recipe, we have a kind of curated collection of tools and gadgets that kind of match that recipe, and you can just buy them directly from the app, which is also really fun.
Whoa! So you can just do it all right there in one app through your phone.
A total experience.
So it just feels like, you know, the caliber of chefs you have, it would make these recipes seem intimidating, but in fact, you know, anybody could create them.
Oh,
is what you're
absolutely!
Saying.
And some of them are really down to earth. The Mario Batali, Judy Rogers. So down-to-earth recipes, so practical, you know, with that innovative twist.
Yeah.
And then some are really, you know, Grant Achatz or Danielle Hume have these very sophisticated multi-step recipes, but you could totally do them at home with the aid of this app, which makes it really
fun. Do you need
fun.
To buy, like if you were going to do like a Grant Achatz, do you need to buy like a...
Actually, Grant Achatz's recipe, I was so shocked. It was completely doable at home with your everyday whatever.
Not like magical air foam with like kiwi
essence.
Not in
this particular case. So
one of my favorites.
Well, we really wanted to make this app something that is useful for home cooks. That was really how we wanted, you know, to present all the recipes, you know, so it's... They are totally doable, and and we gave alternatives. So if some things do need specialized equipment, like sous vide machines or liquid nitrogen, we did give the chefs offered alternatives. If you don't happen to have those things right there in your kitchen,
yeah. I'm a super cooking novice, so I am. I think one of the biggest flaws of cookbooks are you're just looking at a picture of a finished product, and you're not really being brought through step by step, like. I tried to roast a chicken a month ago, and I was like looking at one video on how to carve it, one video on how to tie it up. You know, Is that basically what you guys are creating, is something that has all of that in one place?
Absolutely. For one thing, it has everything in one place. And the other thing, which you don't find online, and I think is kind of disturbing, is that you know where it's coming from. You know that you can trust it. You know it's a James Beard Foundation. You know these particular chefs. So, you know, when you just search things online, you know, that's the difference between just online search and you know, buying a cookbook, is that you know you trust the author. So it gives you both of these. It gives you the authority, but it gives you these step-by-step videos and that really break, you know, oh, what, when you say it should be thickened, what does that mean? Oh, that's what it looks like. Okay.
It doesn't presume anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you can see exactly what you're trying to create at every step of the way. So, yeah.
So is this a starting off point for the whole series of
James Beard
apps.
Perhaps. We would love for it to go that way, you know.
Yeah.
It certainly has that possibility, but we'll see.
It would be a logical progression.
We would love for it to continue, you know, but we figured one app at a time.
One app at a time.
That's the way to go.
So, I like that.
So what the full-blown app, where you're not just getting the free 5 recipes, mm-hmm. how much is that?
It's 22 recipes. Each one, you know, some of them have 22 steps and some of them have, you know, 8 steps, depending on how. So a lot of them teach you, incorporate a variety of basic methods, so you could apply them to other things as well. A lot of them, you know, are more specific, so it depends. And each chef has 1 to 2 recipes in there, and all the chefs are just really amazing.
Do you have any favorite recipes in there, Yael?
Yeah, I wanted to know if she tried any.
we tried all of them. We created them all. We recreated them all, I should say. I love Judy Rogers. You know, it's so sad she passed away, you know, kind of while we were doing this. And she has 2 recipes in there that are just so... they're delicious and they're creative and they're simple to do, but she has this voice, you know, she has this tone when she tells you how to make something that's so lovely and, you know, really pays attention to detail. So yeah, those are a couple of my favorites.
So how do we get it?
Yeah, how do we get it?
So, well, you can go to the James Beard Foundation website, and they have a link to the app, or you can go to Kinetic Art's website. Kinetic Art is kineticart.co. It's easy. And there's a download link right there. You can search for it on the iTunes, on the App Store. You just have to write in the James Beard Foundation vegetables, and then you'll find it. Any and all of those ways work.
Great. And it's coming to the other kinds of phones?
Yeah. So we'll have it for iPad.
What are those? If it's not an iPhone, it's, I don't know what something
actually, else. I have to say the new iPhone 6, because it's bigger. It looks, you know, the bigger the screen, the more beautiful it looks, obviously. So it actually works really well.
Are you working for our iPhone?
Yeah, no.
Who are you here for, really?
No, really not. but so we're hoping for the iPad in a couple of months and Android following that. So
fantastic. Well, we're very, very excited about this. It sounds like the best food app ever.
Of course it is.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to download this when I get home.
I did it.
But before we do that,
yes,
I think, Sari, yes, it's time.
It's time.
For the morning after quiz.
Woohoo!
The morning after quiz, where we basically ask guests things that rhyme with their name or what they do that I imagine they know nothing about. So, Lauren Grimm and Yael, you should totally jump in on this, okay? Because now you know everything about Grimm Artisanal Ales because you sat through this interview.
Yes, exactly.
But I do want to know, Lauren, what you know about Grimm's fairy tales. Are you prepared for the morning after quiz?
I am not prepared.
As prepared as you'll ever be.
Well, I think you should point out what you said before about Joe.
Yeah, I was going to say, said, well, you know, your husband Joe, I mean, he was the one born with the name Grimm.
Yeah, so he if he were here today, he could draw on his knowledge from, you know, his point of birth to today and reading all the Grimm's fairy tales.
So it's good that he's not here, because he would actually know the answer.
You know, I'm not sure. I tried really hard, Sari. I tried really hard.
No, I agree.
I'm scared, though.
Yeah,
no,
hard.
I'm kidding.
Her quizzes are very hard.
Yeah, and when you don't get it, like, you don't even know what happens.
Whoa.
You'll see. Okay, all right. You guys ready? All right. Question one. First published in 1812 by the Grimm brothers, some of their themes were deemed inappropriate for children. Which of these themes were not adjusted? Is it A, gratuitous violence against villains? Is it B, evil mothers changed to evil stepmothers, giving all evil stepmothers everywhere a bad name? Or is it C, sexual references such as Rapunzel's unexpected bun in the oven out of wedlock? Scandalous.
Whoa. I'm going to go with stepmothers.
The one that hasn't changed was what?
Yeah, you? Like what hasn't changed
the
throughout?
Third, I would say the third one.
Say the third one? The sexual references?
I don't know, yeah.
Well, actually, ladies, it was the first one. Oh. In fact, so when it was published in 1812, people were like, oh, mothers can't be evil. Let's make them stepmothers, because stepmothers mean less to you than your mother, I guess. I don't know. That's an awful way to put it. And then also, there were apparently sexual references about, like, you know, birth out of wedlock and all this kind of stuff. So the only thing that has continued streamlined and actually increased is the violence against the villains.
Ew.
In the Grimm fairy tales.
They are very violent.
They are very violent.
And that's and for sure.
It's very interesting that in 1812 they were like, well, let's keep that violence.
Yeah.
Like, that's good.
Well, if they're a villain,
for
they
children.
Deserve it.
That's okay. Totally, yeah. Good for children.
Have you ever read any of the Grimm fairy tales to your children?
Yeah. Yeah, and there are all these versions of them, right? There's the Grimm sisters now. Then there's A Tale Dark and Grimm. Which my daughter loves.
God, I should have asked you when I was researching Grimm fairy tales about this.
Like the new incarnations, and they're all very violent.
They're all, exactly. Okay, all right. Well, continuing on. Question two about Grimm fairy tales. Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm were uber German.
Therefore, nice pronunciation.
Thank you. I do work at Terroir. I talk about Riesling all the time. Therefore, the fairy tales all originally have German titles. Which of these is the original name for Cinderella?
Whoa.
Gets ready. Original name for Cinderella in German. Is it A, Das Lumpengeisendel? Is it B, Aschenputtel? Or is it C, Marchen von einem der Aussag das Fürchten zu lernen?
I thought you would never stop.
They all sound like sexually inappropriate.
They got rid of that part, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. My favorite was Aschenputtel. So I don't know what that means, but it's clear and sounds nice.
Right. Lauren says Aschenputtel.
Yeah. I can't even repronounce it. Sorry.
A, B, or C? I don't even remember. Yeah. I blacked out during that moment. Wait, it actually is B.
Aschenputtel. Yes.
The first one that I tried to pronounce, Das Lumpengeisendel, is the pack of ragamuffins, which is translated in English that way. And then C, Marchen von einem der Aussag das Fürchten zu lernen, is... I did not take German, by the way. is actually called The Story of the Youth Who Went Forth to Learn What Fear Was.
Oh, wow.
Good. Which thing. And it's funny, because when she first read it, I thought that was just one very long word. And I was like, of course the Germans have one word to describe going out to learn, like, what the essence of true fear.
Yeah.
I'm sure they do, actually. I'm sure there is one word.
I know. But it's not the name of Cinderella.
No.
Okay. Final question.
Wait, Aschenputtel, though. What is it?
It's Cinderella.
It just means
ashen. Ashen from, like, ashes. Oh. Right. That makes sense.
Oh. And Putin, like Putin.
Going back,
like,
to
going
our
back
Russian.
To the original.
No.
Oh, I actually didn't take German either.
Poodle.
Poodle.
Yeah. Who knows? Let's not go there.
I've been to Germany.
Question three. A not-so-grim fairy tale is the name of what? Hey, Liz, you got that queued up? Is it A, the name of the band who sings the song?
Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good.
And cut.
So, is it the name of the band that sings that song? Is it B, a sappy 2 out of 5 star reviewed on Amazon romance novel? Or is it C, a political anti-Disney action group campaigning against the sexist, unrealistic nature of fairy tales?
My guess would be B, but, you know.
All right, Yael says B.
I have to go with A. I feel like B and C, it just does, it, yeah, it's... It, not enough romance to be the title of a romance novel.
That's a really good point.
All right. You know what? Actually, it is B.
It is B.
Yeah, it's a terrible, you know, sappy romance novel about not so bright prince looking for the love of his life and his, like, sister, who's probably actually his real true love, like, helping him find
is
it.
Is there a stepmother?
I think there was a stepsister.
Is there
actually.
Violence? Is there?
There was a sword on the cover, so I'm imagining it. But
you haven't
but,
watched, okay?
No, actually, the band who sings that song is the is called Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs.
That's
just
that's
in
a good,
case.
That's, you guys, that's a better
just in case
name.
They're listening.
All right, I'm going to say I think you guys probably both got like one right.
Everybody wins and
thank
loses.
You, thank you for playing the morning after quiz. Thank
Are you
so going to
record a voicemail on my home answering machine?
Yes, I 100% will. If I am ever put in the camp of Carl Castle, I will 100% do that. Oh, wait, don't tell me references all day long. Sari, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much to Yael Raviv.
Thank you.
Download
guys.
The new James Beard app. And Lauren Grimm, thank you so much.
Thanks, and Lauren. Drink and thanks, some, Joe, some wherever you are.
And Joe.
Being a gypsy.
This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.